empty that fuel tank, it's time for another flat chat. Now with August's edition of GP Racing now on the shelves, featuring an exclusive interview with Carlos Sainz as the cover feature and an exclusive interview with Esteban Ocon. With considerable, not to say enormous, prescience, we wrote "The Future's Bright" for Esteban Ocon on the cover, which was printed and in the post to subscribers while he was winning the Hungarian Grand Prix. Either you got this month's magazine out in record time, or this is an incredibly prophetic cover story, said Simon Woodward on Twitter. Or did we just get a little bit lucky with the timing? Anyway, joining me to discuss the appliance of prescience are Mark Gallagher.
Delighted to be here, and well done again on a very suitable front cover. The Ocon thing was inspired.
Let's welcome our other guest, Ben Anderson, whose idea it was. Now, how much was inspiration and how much of it was just blind luck?
It was all inspiration. I knew exactly what was going to happen in Hungary, obviously. I was quite pleased, actually, that he used my cover line on the team radio on the slowing down lap and said, "Allez l'Alpine, allez le bleu!" And I was like, yes, that's exactly what's going to appear on the cover on Thursday. So thanks very much, Esteban. Your check is in the post.
There's been quite a few bits of happenstance in this issue, because obviously we'd been badgering Ferrari for months to interview Carlos Sainz. And as used to be the norm with Ferrari, we really weren't getting very far with that. And then Ben fielded a call. Was it like 4:30 in the afternoon? You got a phone call or an internet letter saying, you can speak to Carlos tomorrow morning. And
doing a bad Italian accent on the phone. yes, good gestures. Have you got the angle of your wrist right there, Connors? I'm not sure. I've been in conversations with Ferrari, or trying to start conversations with the Ferrari, for quite a while. I had this idea in my head at the start of the season that we would do a sequence of cover stories on, you know, the big name drivers who'd move teams, because, you know, it's interesting to know what it's like from the eyes of someone who's not been in that team before. And also, you know, it gives a nice visual flavour, you know, people in new colours, etc. So ticks all the boxes, really, from the magazine point of view. Ferrari, a difficult nut to crack. And I was being, I think the best word for it is ghosted on email and WhatsApp for a while, and thinking, I'm not really getting anywhere. And, you know, traditionally it has been quite difficult to get access to Ferrari. And to be fair to them, not always because they're reticent, just because obviously they're immensely popular and have to field many, many requests, not only editorial such as with us, but commercial. Anyway, I badgered the PR department and finally got through to Silvia at Ferrari. And we had a chat. This was around Styrian Grand Prix time. And she explained to me, actually, that contrary to my expectation, the pandemic, I felt, would make it possibly easier to get access to drivers for interviews, because, you know, the events are closed, so they haven't got so many appearances to do, you know, trips up to the paddock club, etc., etc. Their time, you know, around the Grand Prix weekend is a bit freer, I assumed. But she said actually the opposite's true in their case, because they're doing all of their commercial appearances online as well. So the drivers are basically booked up for wall-to-wall Zoom calls with executives from Shell, Marlboro, whoever. And then they've got to fit, you know, journalist requests in too. And she said, well, we're doing, you know, I think it's something like 2 print interviews a month with the drivers, and that's going to be web as well as magazines. And they were still fielding requests from last year, and we're talking, you know, June, July this year. So I thought, well, I've got, you know, a snowball's chance in hell of getting this interview in time for the August issue, because we would have needed to speak to Carlos by the British Grand Prix at the latest. But anyway, Ferrari's still very helpful. Sylvia, you know, to her credit, said, well, you know, I'll send you the schedule of when he might be available, and we'll work from that basis. And I said, okay, yeah, you know, I'll leave it with you and we'll plan around and hopefully something will come up. And then I thought, right, I'll park that in the back drawer and maybe see Carlos in 2022 or 2023. And then it was about 7 p.m. I think I just got back from a holiday week in Centre Parks with the kids, etc. So it was chaos here, bath time. And suddenly I get a call from Sylvia, which I had to take with my son, you know, screaming away and causing mayhem. But what do you do? And she said, oh, we've got a slot opening up with Carlos tomorrow, 10:30 UK time, for half an hour. And I was like, wow, can you do it? And I was like, well, yes, I'm not going to say no to that. So, yeah, I got my thinking cap on that night, came up with a structure for the interview, and then the next day I spoke to Carlos via Zoom from Maranello. He was there for meetings. This was just after the Austrian Grand Prix. Yeah, we had a really long chat, I think, sort of unprecedented access, really. I remember having one interview with Kimi Raikkonen when he was at Ferrari the second time around, and we did a big cover story for Autosport about his, you know, his career, kind of assessing what kind of driver he was. And that was meant to actually be a 10-minute slot, which lasted an hour, only because Kimi got some momentum going and the PR department decided not to stop him. But on this occasion, we were actually granted a full half an hour with Carlos, so unheard of, really. And it was really enjoyable to speak to him for that amount of time, because you can really then get into the depths of certain topics that you want to cover. And obviously, Carlos is a very bright, engaging individual. So, it was a fun chat, and hopefully that's reflected in the interview. And hopefully it looks good as well. I'm quite pleased with the cover. It's nice to have Ferrari on the cover. And
he really is a chipper off the old block, isn't he, to deal with?
Yes, yes.
You know, when you consider his father, my first interaction ever with the science was a very long time ago, when I was covering Formula One and was then asked to suddenly do an RAC rally by the editor of the Sunday Express. And I arranged to go down to Wales to pre-RAC rally testing to interview Juha Kankkonen and Carlos Sainz, and then received a phone call from Carlos Sainz saying, I was just chatting to Juha in the bar, and it turns out you're coming down here tomorrow to interview both of us, so why don't we just do it all together and have dinner? And
excellent.
I remember thinking, that would be like a journalist who had never been to a Formula One race getting a phone call from Ayrton Senna to say, do you want to have dinner with me and Alain tomorrow night?
It was, hang on, just, that would never happen, would it? Ayrton and Alain having dinner?
And it was just staggering, you know. So, well, they could tick each other off at the buffet, couldn't they?
Yeah, exactly.
And you would have to pick up the bill.
But yeah, the salad bar would be a massive shunt.
And it's great to see Carlos Jr. Just pick up, really, from, I was about to say, where his father left off. His father hasn't left off yet. He's still going strong. Fantastic to see.
Yeah.
But yeah, Carlos Jr., he just comes across so well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And I mean, how did you find him to interview in terms of his preparedness for whatever you threw at him? Because some drivers can be incredibly wary, and you get the kind of 10-second pause when you ask a question, because they're thinking, oh, should I answer this question, or was he very fluent?
No, he was very fluent. I mean, I think I have a slight advantage in this context, because I met the Sainz family way, way, way back. Actually, the first time I met Carlos Jr., he was in Formula BMW. I was doing a very random Formula BMW track test come school event thing at the Ricardo Tormo circuit in Valencia for Autosport. This would have been 11 years ago, maybe, quite early into my Autosport career. And he was there as a kind of, you know, current BMW driver. And I remember we talked a bit, and he commented on the fact that the first corner at that circuit, which is a fast left-hand sweep, had an advantage over the other drivers, because I had a reasonably established amateur racing career by that point. I wasn't a complete rookie, and I was going onto the speed limiter and as fast as possible through that corner, which I think quite impressed him compared to the other journos who were out in the car. And then we talked a bit about, you know, his history, and he had a rivalry with Kvyat at the time because they were on the Red Bull program. Anyway, then I came across them again when he was in British Formula 3, and that's when I met Senior, who obviously was, you know, effectively managing his son's career, obviously following it very closely. And he came to talk to me about what I find very impressive about Sainz Senior is he knows what he doesn't know. And so he realises, well, rallying is my arena, and I know almost everything there is to know about that. Not that he's not curious, but in the other contexts, and certainly the ones that his son's been racing in, he's a sponge, and he will talk to whoever he can talk to glean information, understand better that category, the inner workings, the politics, the teams, etc. So there was a bit of that going on. And then I came across Sainz Jr. again when he was on the verge of breaking into F1. He had that test in Abu Dhabi at the end of 2014 that was crucial. So those pre-dealings, and then obviously he began his F1 career at the time when I was a Grand Prix editor of Autosport. So I was following his races very closely, even though he wasn't one of the top runners or such an established ace in the category as he is now. So we had quite a solid pre-existing relationship, and that really helps, I think, when you get thrown into this situation where he's now in the big leagues, if you like, and not as accessible perhaps as he used to be, like all drivers become as they develop through their career. So it was quite relaxed. It's not obviously as enjoyable as if you're face to face. That obviously wasn't possible this time, but it was as good as. And he didn't take a lot of warming up. We had a fun chat, and he was very I thought he was very interesting, particularly on the details of swapping teams. It's something he's had to do quite a few times in his career, something like 4 times in 7 seasons, which is quite unusual, and I think that's helped him make such a solid fast start with Ferrari. But nevertheless, he talked about some of the details of that process and how when he first drove for Ferrari, obviously he did those days at Fiorano in the old car, I think the 2018 car, wasn't it? And then obviously Bahrain was one test and then you're away. And he said, to begin with, I was driving the Ferrari exactly the same as I drove last year's McLaren. And he said, I got to within a decent lap time, sort of 2 or 3 tenths away from where I wanted to be. And I was like, great, job done. I'm nearly there. And then the point of travel from there to where you need to be, kind of basically where Leclerc is a complete mystery. And he says that's where you have to do an incredible amount of work with your engineers, digging into the data, going on the simulator, trying to adapt your driving style, understand the car, the systems, the tools, everything that's available to you to try and extract basically a couple of tenths of a second. And I just thought that was a very eloquent and interesting explanation of actually the real challenge. We always talk about these drivers, pace is taken for granted. You obviously have to be fast or you can't be a Formula One driver. But there's this really, really small window between there and being at the top, and the vastness of the challenge to jump from that to the next level is probably underappreciated, actually, and probably hasn't been explained quite as well, certainly to me, as Carlos did.
Good to great.
Yeah, good to great.
There's exactly a book on that subject.
Yeah, and that's also where Carlos is quite interesting, because he's had quite a tough career so far in terms of the teammates he's been up against. Obviously he had Verstappen out the box, and then up against Nico Hülkenberg. Lando Norris, obviously, we're seeing the true Lando Norris now, a few seasons in. But nevertheless, that quality of driver was obviously present, perhaps not as consistently, while Sainz was at McLaren. And now, obviously, he goes up against Leclerc, who we know, is a star. He's a Grand Prix winner, and if Ferrari were more competitive, he'd be fighting for world championships already. So you can see that Carlos relishes that challenge, and it also holds no fear for him because he's been there and done it. And I think he feeds off the challenge of having a really, really tough teammate and trying to live up to that and possibly surpass it if he gets enough time. And not every driver is like that. Some drivers prefer an easier ride. Some crumble under the pressure of having a teammate who's quicker than them. But Carlos will hold his hands up and say, well, I've gone into Ferrari and Charles is quicker than me. It's my job to work out how to go as quick as him and then start to bring the car and everything else towards my, what he calls his little preferences. It's very similar to the way Perez talked, actually, about, he said, first you get on the pace and then you talk. But I think the difference is Sainz is finding more consistently that he's closer to the Leclerc's level weekend in, weekend out, whereas Perez is kind of yo-yoing up and down compared to Max. I think it's interesting that kind of Perez has come out of that comfort zone where he's been with one team for such a long time, and now he's in this kind of, massive new challenge situation. And I think it's quite hard for him to grasp the important things he needs consistently to get where he needs to be, whereas Carlos is used to going up against tough guys, never really staying in a team more than a year or two. I mean, he had 3 years at Toro Rosso, and he made a big step in 2017. He was outstanding that year. And he said, you're seeing now with Norris, the third year in a team, you make a huge step in terms of your understanding of how the team works, things like the communication, even in-car radio during the race, everything just comes together and clicks, and you should make a huge step. And Norris has done that this year, and Carlos should do that once we get to kind of 2023, once he's had his time to settle in at Ferrari.
That whole point about the final 0.2, and as you say, I think when people look at Sergio Perez and wonder how can it possibly be so tough to go up against Max, well, the answer is it is. It's incredibly tough. Or Daniel Ricciardo against, as you say, Lando Norris, season 3 at McLaren. You know, Daniel has a few times kind of mentioned, he's even said, you know, there's things I don't want to talk about or I can't really mention. And you kind of, you feel that he's arrived in that team only to discover the degree to which it is Lando Norris's team now.
He said after Austria qualifying, this I thought was an astonishing admission for a, you know, multiple Grand Prix winner. When Norris did that incredible Q3 lap and almost took pole off Max. And Ricciardo was out in Q2, wasn't he? 14th or something, you know, kind of roughly where he's been qualifying a lot this year. And he said he almost stumbled over his words. You know, he congratulated Lando, but he said, I don't know how to get that lap time. There was about a second difference, which on that circuit, you know, it's a short lap, isn't it? It's less than 70 seconds in qualifying. A second off, and he doesn't know where that time is. And if you think of science talking about the 0.2 that he needs, 2-3 to get to Leclerc consistently, Danny Rick's got sometimes a second to find, and he doesn't know where it is. Yeah. And that just shows, you know, how difficult it is to go into a new team, adapt yourself to a different car concept, when you've got a teammate also who's been through that process, having been ingrained in that team before they arrived in Formula One, let's not forget. I think it takes longer than people appreciate, even very, very good drivers.
Yeah.
And also it can sometimes shock even the drivers who go into those environments.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the case for Danny.
I think the point about learning how to work with the team in terms of the people is incredibly important, because you think about how in any work, any job you do anywhere, that initial period when you're getting to know the people who you're working with in the office, you know, how they are, how they respond under pressure, how you operate in that particular environment, then you apply it to the relentless pressure and pace of Formula One at the top level. And it only requires, you know, just a few mishits between individuals, maybe just not quite communicating in the right way, and then on top of that, all of the complexity, as you say, of learning the idiosyncrasies of every car. And I mean, I think that's a really important insight. And you know, I think for listeners, we all do the same thing. Sure, I know I do. You look at the times and you look at the teammates and you think, oh wow, he's not doing very well. You know, he's 0.3 off his teammate, and you know, we all know that 2 or 3 off is just about acceptable. You know, once you're kind of half a second off, people start asking big questions about how you're performing. And I think in this digital age of Formula One, where everything is managed to within, you know, a thousandth of a second in terms of the data and the data analytics and the car setup and all of the simulation software that's used. And then you have a human being who has to drive that car to that level. And it's an insanely tough challenge to do that. And when you have a Max Verstappen at the top of the game or a Lewis Hamilton, then a Sergio Perez or a Valtteri Bottas, I mean, apart from the fact that perhaps they lack that final tiny little piece of whatever it is that a Max or a Lewis has, then on top of that, you've got all of that learning about the car to go on. I think, as you also rightly point out, Carlos has had a tough trajectory in terms of who he's been up against. And it must be hard not to start to worry that your role in life is the sort of perennial number two. You know, you're just constantly going to be learning to catch up, because presumably Charles Leclerc hasn't come into Formula One with Ferrari and said, I'm going to stop developing. So no matter how much Carlos Sainz improves, Charles Leclerc is also looking to improve. So it's I think that whole aspect, that whole dynamic is a really interesting one. And I mean, we were talking before we started recording this podcast about, you know, the way social media can be and what a negative environment it is. And I think that's something that actually a great many fans misunderstand about the complexity of Formula One, how difficult it is for two teammates to be on absolute level pegging. It's almost impossible to get to that point, because by definition there's differences, you know, across two people, even if they do have identical equipment.
Well, Carlos is interesting on that point too, because he talks about self-belief in the interview and how not only the tough journey he's had within Formula One, I mean, you know, people would dispute the definition of the word tough if we apply it to, you know, a guy who's managed to race, you know, Formula One cars for a living for many different, you know, high level teams. But he talks about how, you know, there were lots of difficult moments before he even arrived in Formula One, and he references 2014. So, you know, he was basically given the ultimatum by Helmut Marko to win what was then the Renault World Series Formula 3.5 championship, or that was it, and he managed to do it. And then obviously that test I mentioned in Abu Dhabi was quite important for him to seal his promotion. And he says those situations where you don't know whether it's going to work out, you know, you've poured your heart and soul into getting to Formula One, and it might be ripped away from you at a moment's notice. He says those situations have been very, very challenging to deal with mentally, but he's always believed in his talent and in this almost power of positivity. You know, he's always pushed through the demanding situations, and in the end things have worked out. You know, he's had situations where he might be dropped by Red Bull, then they don't want to promote him to the top team, and then he ends up at Renault, but they don't want to sign him because it costs too much, and they're in a political fight with Red Bull, and then he winds up at McLaren. He says, I've always ended up landing on my feet, so if I just keep working hard, stay positive, work properly with the people around me, you know, things have turned out to be good, so I'm going to keep going in that way. So he almost has this attitude of, no matter what's thrown at me, it's my job to absorb it and turn it as far to my advantage as I can, and not ever think about these difficulties as a negative. I think also, and this isn't mentioned in the feature, although we did discuss it briefly, he has a very, very good support network around him, which starts with his father, but extends to, you know, his manager, who's a relative of...
Also called Carlos. Family.
Also called Carlos, cousin. Yeah. I call them the three amigos when I see them in the paddock, because it's the three Carloses. But, you know, they're a very tight-knit group, and he has a lot of emotional support around him, which really helps hold him up in these moments of stress and difficulty. And they help him work through these problems, and particularly the off-track stuff, because, you know, he's been a pawn in, you know, team driver shuffles in the past, and having those guys who can take a step back, you know, write it out on a whiteboard and say, right, well, these are the permutations, and if this happens, then he'll go there and he'll probably go there and we should look to go here. That's really helped Carlos. We've seen, I think, drivers on the Red Bull scheme, particularly in the past, who kind of trust their whole career to Red Bull, don't have any kind of other support network around them in terms of management and, you know, off-track politics, and they just end up cut adrift or with nowhere else to go. And those are promising careers that could have flourished outside of that system had there just been a little bit more foresight and someone taking a step back. And Carlos, to his credit and to his family's credit, they've had that. So when the Red Bull situation didn't look like it was going to work out, they were able to put themselves in the right place and have the right conversations and forge their own path. And now he's one of... I think he's the only driver, isn't he, to still be racing in F1 out of the Red Bull scheme who didn't race for the parent team.
Okay.
He's the only the only ex-Toro Rosso driver who never got promoted to Red Bull to still be in Formula One, or to have, you know, forged their career outside.
But again, I think that very much reflects the support package around him, because, as you say, he has his father, he has his manager... his father's network and connections must be truly formidable. There wouldn't be anywhere in motorsport that...
Well, he even had your number, Mark. You know, he can call up anyone unexpectedly, and no one will refuse the call of Carlos Sainz.
Yeah. He's a legend. Who the hell is this? Carlos, who? Yeah.
He's a legend, and people will rightly give him the time of day.
Yeah. So I think from that perspective, the young drivers who... are utterly beholden to Helmut Marko and Red Bull, more than ever need to have their own management. And I think that's one of the flaws of that structure, is that, you know, once you're completely beholden to the Red Bull driver program, it doesn't give you much scope to do other things. And
it's where Verstappen was clever as well, wasn't it? You know, his dad and Raymond, I mean, his manager, they always did their own thing, even once they were inside the Red Bull system. They always had their own thing going on, making sure they were aware of other moves, just to make sure that, you know, they had some protection against, you know, what can be quite a ruthless environment.
Another thing that I found related to that was interesting and quite heartening is, you know, historically Ferrari is very much a bear pit politically, but Carlos sort of alluded to a new approach that comes from the very top, comes from Mattia Binotto and Laurent Mekki, is that they're almost trying to de-Ferrarificate it. You know, if something goes wrong, someone doesn't
in the
get
dictionary,
pushed
that
off
word,
a bridge
Connors?
Or something. De-Ferrarificated. You know, it tended to be that any mishap would be rewarded with internal chaos and wrangling and the blame game. And they seem to be trying to dial that out of the machine to great effect, because they've managed to turn around what was quite a tricky technical package, which, you know, they weren't really allowed to do very much to between 2020 and 2021. They've had a very limited window of opportunity to improve that car. And from what we've seen so far, they appear to have made the right choices. And what do you know? I mean, feel free to disagree with me. I would say, actually, pound for pound, Leclerc and Sainz are probably the strongest driver pairing, you know, as a combination, probably the strongest pairing on the grid.
Well, that's what Mattia Binotto has said. And I mean, I guess he would say that, but I think he is right. And if you look at the championship table, I mean, there's 3 points between them. To be fair, obviously, to Leclerc, he's had a couple of big results go begging to misfortune, not of his making, but I think they are. I think Sainz and Norris was probably the best balanced pairing when they were at McLaren. And now Sainz has gone to Ferrari alongside another, you know, absolute top line driver. Yes, they do have the best pairing on the grid that will probably only get better as well, given their age and obviously Sainz's relative lack of experience inside that team. I thought it was really interesting that he, in talking about the culture shift, which is really, you know, I led him into that by just talking about what I've noticed kind of under Binotto, that Ferrari just seems to be a little bit more prepared to hold its hands up, admit some of its failings, talk more openly about, you know, what they're getting wrong with the car and how they might fix it. I think with this year's package, they had some pretty low-hanging fruit to grasp following the kind of engine debacle or fuel flow debacle of 2019 into 2020. And then them obviously, you know, misfiring with last year's car in terms of their targets. You know, it was, I think, quite relatively straightforward for them to fix that once they could get, you know, those tokens spent and undo some of the things that they mistakenly did. But Sainz mentions particularly the process on a race weekend, and obviously this was just after the Austrian Grand Prix that we were talking, so he referenced Austria qualifying, where Ferrari were kind of borderline Q3 and they stuck with their strategy to qualify on the medium tyre in Q2 so that they would have a better tyre to start the race on, and that meant not necessarily getting through to Q3 with both cars because it was marginal, and they didn't, in fact. And he said in the past, Ferrari, with all the external pressure and everything else, which is still there, of course, especially from Italy, there would have been a decision made really against the bigger picture that we need to get the cars into Q3 if they can go there. So let's chuck the soft tyre on and do it and basically screw our race over. But they didn't do that. They stuck to their guns. And then obviously they recovered in the race. They had a pretty strong race as it was. Sainz came through from outside the top 10 on the grid. Leclerc did pretty well, even though he was driven off the road by Perez. So he said that he was really encouraged to see that the calmness and, you know, sticking to and trusting in good planning that was present in for the Ferrari that he's racing for. And it made me think of that Japanese Grand Prix weekend under Maurizio Arrivabene, where there were mixed conditions and Ferrari were all over the place with their tyre choice, or refusing to send Leclerc out again in Q1 in Monaco because they thought they'd done enough. And then he ended up, you know, losing a probably nailed on pole I think this was 2018.
The idea of the Oliver Burnet regime.
Just a silly strategy call, needless. And Ferrari don't make those kind of blunders at the moment. You know, they still make mistakes like any team does, but they just seem to have, you know, just a better kind of strategic thinking and process in place. And science mentions not only Mattia, but Laurent Mekies as being key in trying to turn, as ever with these massive teams, you know, this massive ship, this tanker, gradually around to just a kind of, you know, more straightforward, less pressurized way of thinking. And it seems to be bearing fruit. He said he was glad that we'd noticed this culture shift because he can see it from inside, even though he's new to the team. He's aware that they're going through this process, and he's really enjoying being part of that.
I think one of the things that's interesting about Ferrari is that the current CEO, albeit I think it's temporary, is John Elkann, who is the chairman of effectively the parent company, the whole parent company. And of course, he took over from Gianni Agnelli as grandfather, as sort of head of that dynasty. And I was quite struck last year when Elkann was asked in an interview about the troubles that Ferrari were having in 2020. And instead of giving an answer that showed that the team was having lots of pressure piled on it by the shareholders and by the senior, you know, the executive board, he said the opposite. He said, we want to give Mattia the time, and we want to give Ferrari the opportunity, and this is a 3 to 5 year program. And I thought, wow, that's the first time I've ever heard anyone at that level give Scuderia Ferrari time. And time and support. And if Laurent Mekies and Mattia Binotto have that support, where John Elkann and the other board members are saying, just show us your plan and go on that trajectory. And yes, it might take 3 years, but when we get there, then hopefully we get to a position where we can genuinely compete to win the world championship and take the fight to Mercedes and Red Bull in a sustainable way. And I thought that was very interesting. John Elkann's an interesting character because he's quite young. He's, you know, for a chief executive of Ferrari, he's only 45. And the other thing is he's an extremely accomplished sailor, and he competes in long distance sailing races. And
so he knows how to bide his time.
Well, I think there's a very important point there, because actually when you yourself are used to competing, you start to appreciate the complexity involved in winning. And, you know, I've watched some of the events that he's taken part in, and, you know, one year he turns up and he finishes 18th, and the next year he turns up and he finishes, I don't know, 6th or 4th, and you can see there's been progress. So I suspect that at the very top of Ferrari, we have a genuinely new approach. And they knew they weren't going to fix the, after the engine fuel flow debacle of 2019, they knew they weren't going to fix that overnight. So it was about pressing the reset button, creating a platform, looking forward to 2022. And actually this year, they're acquitting themselves very well. And aside from having Esteban Ocon on the cover, which was inspired, of course, you know, Carlos has just had his third position in his podium at the last Grand Prix in Hungary, pending, of course, the Aston Martin appeal over their disqualification. So, you know, solid result there for him as well. So, yeah, really, I think a new era for Ferrari, and hopefully they'll keep that positive trajectory going once we see the new look improved Formula One in 2022.
Well, we await, don't we? And we do. With a certain degree of scepticism. Shall we? It's just getting really good,
and they're going to rip it all up and start again. Yeah. Someone will be a second ahead, and somebody will be 5 seconds off the pace, and we'll all be going, ah.
Yeah, can you just imagine that, you know, as we're all sitting here in the summer of 2021 saying, oh, you know, let's hope 2022 works out really well. And you just kind of, there's a little bit of a, in the pit of our stomach, we know that there's an Adrian Newey or a James Allison or someone sitting in their office today going, I just can't believe we found the loophole. You know, we found the thing that everyone in F1 and the FIA missed when they looked at these regs. And you know, it'll be the 2022 equivalent of the double diffuser or
there's something that fills me with dread, because Ben Edwards, our F1 analyst columnist, has written a column for the next issue of GP Racing, which comes out just before the Belgian Grand Prix, about, you know, the 2022 regs and some of the kind of nuances there, and the people who will be beavering away, not working on this year's racing program, you know, the guys who are kind of tasked with exactly that, you know, sifting through the every word, every sentence, trying to find out what they can do.
Truffle hunting, as James Allison calls it.
Exactly. And it won't be James Allison's job, because Ben's column in this August issue says, you know, he has stepped away from that. It's someone else's job now. Certain things like braking systems will be open source now. So he said, he talks about how, I mean, obviously I'm preempting an issue now, but he talks about how there'll be certain people who've been working on certain parts of Formula One for a long time, you know, innovating, trying to discover better, faster ways of doing things, and it will all be given up. So you're going to have some, you know, big disappointment there, and some people having to give up their secrets. But then also the move towards a kind of return to ground effect, a modern version of it, not the kind of, you know, absolutely scatty, insane 80s version.
The roller skates of 1982.
Yeah, there's going to be a move, obviously, towards that, and having a few of the kind of, you know, above surface appendages. And he also says that it likely means, you know, not so much high rake. And then you suddenly think, well, who've been the masters of low rake Formula One for the last, you know, umpteen years? And it's the team in black, isn't it? So you start to think, well, is it all aligning for Mercedes, who, as we detail in Andrew Benson's excellent feature in this month's issue, you know, have basically drawn their line in the sand and said, we will not compromise 2022 for the sake of 8 and 8. So are they actually in the process of, you know, designing the perfect 2022 Formula One car and about to disappear into the distance again, just as things have got really tasty for spectators?
Yeah, well, considering they're leading both championships in a year, they're apparently not trying very hard.
I know.
it's rather a worry, isn't it?
Yeah.
They say that, but Toto was very outspoken in when he was talking to Andrew Benson for this feature about, you know, Mercedes and their troubles in this month's issue. He said, you know, we won't resign. The design effort and input into the current car will taper, has tapered already, but they're not going to give up. And what we've seen over the past two or three races is Mercedes not giving up. You know, they've added the final update package to that car at Silverstone. And now, you know, the race team is fully focused on extracting the maximum from that. And, well,
But they're struggling to do it, though, aren't they? You know, they're under massive pressure, regardless of, you know, some slightly fortuitous circumstances. You know, Bottas basically taking out both Red Bulls.
The crinkle of tinfoil hat can be heard from here.
I don't think that was in James Vowell's pre-race strategy plan. But nevertheless,
Valtteri, it's James.
Nevertheless, it worked out quite well. You know, they are making heavy weather even of those kind of opportunities. You know, the decision not to pull Lewis in before the start in Hungary, and meaning he had to come from the back. He should have won that race, and he didn't, because they made a wrong call. You know, he's under pressure from Max. So, you know, things are getting testy there. We've seen some strategy errors from Mercedes earlier in the season. So, you know, in terms of not giving up, that's fine. But they're putting a lot more pressure on themselves and making more mistakes as a result of that, I think. And it seems, yes, they found a small step with the car from the Silverstone update, and maybe something in the engine too. I mean, we have a feature by UCODders this month about, you know, the unseen battleground fuel and lubes development, which obviously is something that's been going on for, you know, since time began, but yeah. You know, it's getting ever more. It's one of the areas that's still pretty unfettered in terms of you know, the rules.
There are
more and more exotic things that those companies in partnership with their teams can develop, and it seems that ExxonMobil have made a big step that's allowed Honda to get more performance out of an engine without being allowed to update it, which was a big mystery around the kind of Austria double header France leg of the season, and perhaps Petronas has responded, and now we're seeing Mercedes, which let's not forget is under kind of new management in the engine department this year, so maybe it's just taken a bit of time for them to get their ducks in a row, and now we're seeing a response from Brixworth in conjunction with obviously Mercedes throwing their last truffles at the W12. But this will be what they have. And I mean, still Red Bull are right there. Okay, Max was, you know, he wasn't able to get pole in Hungary, and that will perplex Red Bull, I think, because you would have expected them to be probably ahead on that track, and they weren't. So, but I mean, in Benson's feature, Christian Horner indicates that they'll keep going to Abu Dhabi if needs be, throwing stuff at the car. So even if Mercedes has done a good job to kind of take big points away from Red Bull in a couple of events where they weren't quite necessarily maybe the favourites, I don't see in the second half of the year how they can maintain this tighter fight still without continuing to push in the same way that Red Bull has said it will.
Yeah, interesting.
And they are pulling out all the stops, aren't they, in terms of the fuel story was very interesting in terms of what they're putting into fuel completely legally. There's this additive that Mobil have found from the cosmetics industry that enables them to unlock something. Obviously they're cagey as hell, but as Ben said, the business of fuel and lubes has been going on since the year dot. I was just reading Richard Williams' excellent book about Enzo Ferrari's life the other day, and there's a remarkable passage about a pre-war Grand Prix. It was the one where obviously the Italians had pushed to go into voiturette racing because they couldn't compete with the big German teams, and the Mercedes completely behind closed doors without anyone knowing produced a 1.5 litre blown car for the voiturette competition, which blew everyone out of the water, and it had some mystery fuel. And there's this lovely little detail about one of the Ferrari drivers, I think, was behind a Mercedes, and he was so overcome by the fumes that when he came into the pits and they gave him a lemon to suck on to sort of moisten his mouth and a sponge to wipe all the crap off his
lemon?
Face.
Lemon? How cruel!
Apparently he wiped his face with the lemon and chewed the sponge.
He gave himself a tequila suicide and then re-entered the race.
I really think we need to see Carlos Sainz or Charles Leclerc come in for a pit stop and be handed a lemon. I think
yes, there aren't enough lemons in Formula One pit stops. Maybe the technical directive will address that.
There might be some sort of dimensional guidelines relating to the lemons, how they're sliced, lengthways, yeah, or across.
They can't be administered on sensors. It must be done manually.
Yeah, and you need to be able to get a litre of juice out of the lemon at the end of the race. You squeeze it hard. The fuel and lubricants thing is fascinating because it's misunderstood because it's all down to chemistry, and it's definitely a black art. And I know it was 10 years ago, but when I was running the Cosworth F1 program, our relationship with BP Castrol and their scientists in Pangbourne in Berkshire, which is where their R&D base is, they would provide us with suites of lubricant and fuel, which we could try out. And obviously we were running customer engines for small teams and for Williams, and there was no
development. Them the rubbish stuff.
there was no development budget, and to speak of, really no development budget. But even then, we managed to convince, I'm trying to think which team signed up for it. I think it was, well, certainly Williams, but I think possibly Manor contributed some as well. Anyway, we did some fuel and lubricants development for 2 years. And we could realistically expect to find another 1% of power. So at that time we had 780 brake horsepower, so we could find 6, 7, 8 brake horsepower per year through fuel and lubes development, and that was with an incredibly limited program. If you had the complete buy-in of an ExxonMobil, I can imagine you could be really pushing on to find some quite decent improvements. And of course, as you say, Stuart, it's not as if they're throwing in any illegal substances. There is a base product which has to meet the FIA regulation requirements in terms of additives and use of detergents and obviously the octane level, but there's actually quite a lot of scope to play around with what the way in which you mix those ingredients. And then, as you say, if you find a new ingredient that's permitted, you can bring that into play and all of a sudden you can start to make great progress. But again, it's an interesting point as well that engine development is not included within the budget cap restrictions, and so therefore it's an opportunity to squeeze additional performance, which then, you know, definitely brings something to the table. And
especially this year as well, when the engines are frozen as part of the cost saving before 2022, the specs are frozen, so this is one of the few things you can throw at the engine to get
it's
more out.
Another truffle.
And they need to be, there's a lot more in reliability now, isn't there, with these engines, because the internal combustion engine is smaller and they're running them so lean in terms of the fuel mixture.
Sure,
the more protective elements you can find in there that don't cost you in terms of friction, etc., then the better off you are, because all the teams are limited in terms of how long they can run their engines at full power, even not quite full power. So the more your partner can give you in terms of, you can run that for another 10 laps at that setting or another 3 sessions at that setting, the better off you are and the more performant you're going to be. So it's where reliability becomes performance, probably more so than in the V8 days.
It seems to have been transformative for Red Bull, doesn't it? Because obviously one of their behind-the-scenes bugbears with Renault was that they couldn't get any dyno time at Viry with the Mobil 1 fuel and lubes in the engine. It was all done with, was it Total or was it BP Castrol that
they had Castrol Renault by that point, I think. They nicked Castrol from McLaren. And Renault prioritised, obviously, their own programme at Viry. And, Christian Horner was forever, frustrated that they couldn't, because they had a different partner, but the same engine.
Frustration is his middle name.
They couldn't get their fuel into the engine for dyno time. So they were kind of having to make do a bit. And one of the big advantages they have of partnering with Honda was they could finally align everything. And you're seeing the fruits of that now. And I think the scary thing is, in that story, Cod, is that Mobil feel that this step they've made in terms of fuel and lubes has just unlocked the beginnings of a new cycle of development for Honda. So there'll be more to come from that package, even without Honda chucking new bits at the engine, which obviously they can't do this year, but one presumes they will be able to do so again.
Look, they can make changes for reliability.
Of course, yes.
you'd speak to racing drivers who, but back in the day, would say, the Porsche 917, you could run it. It could run all day at, say, 11,000 RPM. But if you took it to 11,100, boom, the pistons bent, valves bent. I'm probably overestimating quite how high that car revved. But by the early 90s, Cosworths were going to, 13,000?
Yes.
Pretty much, I think. Bertrand Gachot said that the HB and the Jordan 191, you could take it up to 11,700. Fine. 13,900. Boom. And there was another bill EJ wasn't going to pay.
Yeah, well, that was actually something that, again, we're prefacing what's in the next edition.
But, in the next issue, yeah.
When I was talking to Trevor Foster, the former managing director of Jordan, and he was race engineer to Michael Schumacher in Spa in 91. He was reminding me that the step between the Series 3 Ford HB and the Series 4 Ford HB was 750 RPM. And he was saying it didn't really produce a lot more power, but it allowed you to play with the gearing quite a bit more, and it just gave you slightly longer legs. And this is at the time when we were still using springs, valve springs. It was pretty impressive technology that they were able to get it to rev that highly. And it is, it's interesting, isn't it? Within the decade, so we're talking about 1991 there, with that sort of moving from 12 to 13,000 RPM. And within the decade, Cosworth had an engine at, you know, 20,000 RPM with pneumatic valves. So yeah, the tech really moved on, didn't it?
If we return to the content of this issue before we go too far into the one we're working at the moment, that we do in Now That Was a Car, we've picked the highly unusual one of a car that didn't have a particularly notable career, the BRM P201, which finished on the podium in its first Grand Prix but then never managed it again. And part of the reason for that was a decision that BRM had taken at the beginning of the 3 litre era to prioritise H16 development, and the V12 engine that they ended up running was very much plan B, and it went into their sports cars, and there was not a single thing they could do to it that would unleash more power. They had consultants working on it. They reversed the flow of the cylinder heads. They changed the firing, or they did all sorts of stuff to it. Nothing could make it more powerful or more reliable. And Part of the problem was that they were trying to run four or five cars at Grand Prix because Louis Stanley liked the money that brought in. The trouble is the engines would blow and then they would just be patched up and put back into service. So there were huge differences between the engines, and all of a sudden you had this scenario of absolute chaos. And Niki Lauda used to enjoy relating the story of how Louis Stanley would entertain these prospective pay drivers at the Dorchester Hotel, and he would have arranged for the phone to ring so that he would be called to an urgent telephone call from the factory. So he'd go off and, you know, wait outside the room for a bit and come back in and say, "Oh, yes, that was the engine department. They found another 60 horsepower with a new exhaust system." And it was said that, you know, if that was true every time he'd uttered those words, then the engine would have been making about 10,000 horsepower by 1974.
Remarkable.
Bit of a shame, because that car was actually so agile and gentle on its tyres, it could race on qualifying tyres. So for a very brief period, it had a fantastic advantage, where if it had had maybe a spicier driver lineup and more consistent engines, you know, more could have happened. BRM might still be on the grid today instead of being a historical footnote. But there are a lot of what ifs in Formula One. Murray Walker did say Formula One is if backwards, which actually it isn't. It's 1F backwards. But
we'll allow it, Murray.
We'll allow it.
And I can see we're coming up to sort of the end of our time. If I can mentally subtract from the amount of time on the clock the amount of time we spent doing our hugely libelous bit that producer Martin has to cut out, we've probably got a little bit more time. We can talk about Esteban Ocon, who's made us look massively, massively clever this month with his victory in Hungary, which owed a little bit to happenstance. But, you know, when all around you are losing their heads, you can relate the rest of the Rudyard Kipling poem and go through the massive gap that's opened up while doing so. Brilliant seizing of the moment there by Esteban, and also a very well-driven race. And that kind of justifies the faith that Alpine have put in him by giving him a 3-year contract when, you know, at various times this year, his performances have been looking a little bit shaky. He's been looking like he's struggling. I think, was it Silverstone they had to give him a new monocoque because just something had got into his head that there was something wrong with the car. And it seems that he now really does feel at home in that team. And the fact that they gave him a new tub suggests that they actually have faith in him, and they're willing to indulge a few of these sort of little worries just to kind of put that figurative arm around him. And they do see him as the future.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I'm fascinated to see what happens next in that story, because winning a Grand Prix does things to a driver. You know, definitely gives you a real sense of achievement and future purpose, and it makes the journey feel worthwhile. And I mean, I was reading all of the responses to the victory from President Manuel Macron of France and Luca De Meo, the chief executive of the Renault Group, and there's been a huge outpouring of celebration about that victory. But I remember very similar occurrences when Olivier Panis won the Monaco Grand Prix in 1996 for Ligier, and that was it. You know, that was it. It was a one-off. It was an unusual race. It was a wet race, drying track, all of that kind of good stuff. And you have to be so careful in racing not to take a victory like they achieved in Hungary and say that it somehow suggests they've cracked the problem. And as you mentioned earlier on, Ben, Lewis Hamilton should have won that race and would have won that race had he come into the pits.
So should Charles Leclerc. If he had been wiped out so by Lance Stroll, he was in pole position coming out of that corner. He would have won that race. So it was a very fortunate win, however well driven by Esteban.
As I posted on social media on Sunday night, you know, the Hungarian Grand Prix was won for Alpine by Fernando Alonso.
Yes. he earned his money there, didn't he?
He earned his money. I mean, there was a wonderful... Somebody managed to put a wonderful meme on social media where they'd taken his car and they'd expanded it to be the entire width of the racing track. And that's how it looked. I mean, an incredible battle. So I think
Alonso took... some joy in posting on social media. I think I saw something.
Yeah, you're right.
He posted a picture of Hannibal from the A-Team, didn't he? Smoking a cigar and there's a big explosion in the background and he says, I love it when a plan comes together.
Yeah.
Well, he's old enough to remember the A-Team, clearly.
So, yeah, you know, so it's fabulous to see that result, but you have to be super careful as to what comes next, because it's arguable that, you know, the Alpine in its current form is some way off the pace of the top teams, and they have an awful lot of work to do if they are to mix it. I mean, we've just talked about the trajectory that Ferrari are on, the focus that Mercedes have in 2022, the fact that Red Bull are constantly on it, the job that McLaren are continuing to do. And I think there are other coming teams in the sport as well. People who are on the rise are thinking about Williams for the future. I think the next 3 to 5 years will be very interesting for Williams. So Alpine need to go some to be able to score that kind of result on merit.
Well, they're maybe fifth best, aren't they? Maybe.
Yeah,
if you take Mercedes and Red Bull, who are definitely a step ahead, as hard as it was for Lewis to get back through the field, you know, on a normal weekend, there's four cars that should be in the top four positions by rights. And then you've got McLaren and Ferrari, definitely the coming teams. But, you know, they're sleeping giants.
Yeah.
And then Alpine, however you want to say it, they're fifth in the championship at the moment. But you would say they've probably moved ahead of Aston Martin, who obviously are running a three-year-old car, nearly a three-year-old car. But, you know, AlphaTauri... You know,
it's quick on the grass, though.
When too quick. When doesn't stop very well. When Gasly, who's been magnificent this season, you know, when he's on it and AlphaTauri get it all together, you know, he's in that fight, off and out qualifying the Alpines.
Yeah.
But they're maybe not quite so consistent. Obviously, the second car isn't there. So probably Alpine have the advantage of a better balanced driver on that. We talked about Sainz and Leclerc being maybe the best balance, but probably Alonso Ocon is not far behind. So you know you're going to have two cars scoring points more often than not, if it's possible. But they are. They're borderline top 10, aren't they? You know, sometimes Q3, sometimes not, depending on the track at the moment. And given the pressure on that whole operation, which you've written about before, Mark, and the trajectory they need to get on quite quickly, I guess this will take some pressure off, but really it's like 2022 is massive for them, isn't it? They really need to take a big step up next year and be right in there with... I mean, it may be too much to expect them to be up with Red Bull and Mercedes. It's maybe too much to expect anyone to be up with them, but they need to be in the mix with Ferrari and McLaren, certainly, you would think, to suggest that they're on the right path. It's not going to be enough to be fifth best or lower.
It's weird, isn't it? The brain drain from Team Enstone really has had an effect. You know, this was a team that was used to winning races, world championships. bunch of very, very steely, determined racers, very innovative in their thinking. And it's kind of, it's almost like they've forgotten how to win. And one of the things that struck me in the aftermath of this race was really that there's a lack of knowledge of how to go about winning and getting there. Like you saw in the final laps, the mechanics unable to look, many of them, because they were so nervous. They didn't know what procedure. Neither Ocon knew nor his people on the pit wall knew what the procedures were if you'd finished on the podium. So he parked at the end of the pit lane and had to run back, so he had his wrist slapped for that. And in the aftermath now, Alpine usually do their one of the few teams that do interviews for print media via Teams, so that you know you're not scrapping around hoping that someone says something interesting on Sky or something. They do go the extra mile to provide access, and obviously they then cancelled those because they thought, well, he's sort of done the press conference, hasn't he? And then they put out on their WhatsApp group, oh, actually, we'll be able to put Fernando up in 10 minutes. Sorry, we're not used to this. So it was a shame we didn't get to speak to Esteban, because what I wanted to ask him was, to what extent were you aware of Lance Stroll's assault on the All-Canadian Grass Tracking Championship going on behind you? Because, you know, when you looked at the onboards, Ocon was just turning into that corner when you just saw this big green shape come flashing past and clonk into Leclerc and part the Red Sea, as it were, in front of him. And he just sort of dashed into that gap. And I was kind of, I wanted to know, as a racer, was he aware of that nonsense going on behind him, or did it just happen and he sort of lucked in? It would have been interesting to have that conversation.
Wasn't he slightly behind it?
Yeah, you did see that he basically got overtaken by Stroll on the grass and he whacked into the thing.
He would have seen that coming. He would have seen Stroll barreling down the inside, then going off the track. And you can see, I think, from the outside on the replay, Ocon just slowing down that little bit more, because he can see that there's already chaos going on ahead, isn't there? So you need to go extra careful. And then there's a little bit of extra chaos on his line. So he just checks up, hopes he doesn't get hit from behind, which thankfully he doesn't, because no one else was being as stupid as Stroll. And then he just drives out on the inside line, and suddenly, oh, there's no one in front of me apart from Lewis. So he would have been thinking, oh, good chance of some big points. He would never have been thinking he was going to win the race. And of course, you know, if Mercedes had been a bit more on it strategically and taken a risk rather than played it conservatively, Lewis would have absolutely walked that race.
And on that note, as Ben Anderson earns us a one-star review from the Lance Stroll fan club, I'm led to believe it's considered poor form for a podcast to run over an hour. Not that we usually let that stop us, but we've only got 3 weeks to do the September issue of GP Racing, so we need to get back on that. Ben's got a mountain of proofs to read, which I then have to take on, and... If we don't get back to that, then the magazine won't arrive on the shelves and the world will end. So it's time for me to say thank you for listening. Thank you to Mark Gallagher for your sagacious input as ever. Enjoy the rest of your holiday, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Taking a brief break from your... It's not a staycation. Is it a staycation if one... No, it's only a staycation if one stays at home. If you're holidaying in the UK, you're just holidaying in the UK.
Yeah, no, I'm staying at home. I'm doing lots of chores around my house and just generally avoiding... working, which is quite pleasant so far. Apart from this, of course, this has been a very enjoyable interlude.
If only you could avoid us, Mark.
Yeah, very enjoyable interlude. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ben. It is time for you to return to the grindstone, where no doubt our managing editor is going, what have they been doing? It was supposed to be at 10 o'clock. So we're going to go...
For regular listeners, he doesn't sound like that.
No, that's the weird thing.
It's one of those impressions that has taken on a life of its own.
It's if you've ever heard David Tremaine trying to do an impression of other people doing an impression of him, it's a little bit like that. What a niche reference to end the podcast with. Anyway, as I said, thank you for listening, and thanks as ever for Martin Lee. It is job chaperoning the nonsense out of this podcast before it gets uploaded. Thank you. We will see you again in about 3 weeks' time, because as I said, it's a 3-week issue just before the Belgian Grand Prix.